to Casual Inference. I'm Lucy D'Agostino McGowan from Wake Forest University.
And I'm Ellie Murray from Boston University. And we are a partnership podcast with the American Journal of Epidemiology.
I'm trying to think if we have any follow-up. The one piece of, it's not follow-up, but it's new. We have a new logo. Yes. That's exciting.
An exciting new logo. I love it. Lucy designed this one.
New season, new logo. It felt like it was appropriate to, I picked some sunshiny colors.
I like it. It's cheerful.
Thank you. As I'm saying this out loud, I'm realizing like I picked like these bright colors in a coffee cup and it probably represents like how tired I'm feeling these days. I'm like, I have to wake up. So hopefully everyone feels wide awake from
aspirational.
That's right. I'm going to inspire everybody to feel awake and excited to talk casually. Okay. Well, speaking of speaking casually about things that are inference, we have a guest today.
Yes, we do. Our guest today is Dr. Ashley Buchanan, who is an assistant professor of biostatistics in the Department of Pharmacy Practice in the College of Pharmacy at the University of Rhode Island. And I have known Ashley for a number of years. We have collaborated on some really cool projects, thinking about infectious diseases in their setting where transmission is happening and so causal inference is hard, and thinking about how to do good studies of that using observational data, but also a lot of the times using simulation modeling so that we can think about, asking a little bit more complicated questions. And so I always have a really fun time talking with Ashley about that. So hopefully we'll chat with her a little bit about that today as well. So I want to start just by thanking Ashley for joining us and maybe ask you, Ashley, to tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do in 280 characters, roughly. At a sort of casual Twitter type level. Yes. So the other thing you should know, sorry, Ashley, the other thing you should know is if you use too technical of a word, Lucy might buzz you and you'll have to give an explanation in lay terms.
That should be helpful. Yeah. Thanks so much for inviting me. You know, I'm really happy to be here and I'm happy to join this discussion. And thanks, Ellie, for the nice introduction. I feel like that laid out a lot of the high level ideas. Broadly what we're thinking about, we're one of many teams working on this. I'm thinking about spillover or what's known as interference. So that's when one person's exposure affects another person's outcome. And the context that we're looking at specific in our current study is looking at HIV prevention interventions among populations of people who use or inject drugs. So they're at high risk for HIV. And we're trying to figure out, what are the spillover mechanisms? How could this be happening? And how can interventions be developed to basically leverage that or improve the spillover in a certain population?
This is so exciting. We just were talking about interference on the last podcast a little bit because we were kind of going back through the types of topics that we've covered. And this is one that comes up. I didn't even have to buzz you because you immediately defined it. So that was fabulous. I'm excited to hear about this specific example. I think we've talked about it in the context of like vaccine trials, for example. But can you tell us about kind of how it fits in with the data that you guys are looking at?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. Yeah, so I think when I look at this literature, it's like historically, it seems to have evolved from answering questions about vaccines, which, you can imagine how that has a natural spillover and sometimes more loosely called herd immunity, although those aren't exactly the same thing. But right, being vaccinated not only protects you, but protects those around you. It maybe just doesn't stop there. There are other public health interventions that have the potential for resonance in a community, in a network, or in a particular group. So the ones that we've been thinking about lately, for example, is pre-exposure prophylaxis. So traditionally, when this was analyzed in clinical trials or other types of studies, they look at what the individual patient was randomized to. But then when we start thinking about it more, we realize that a person being randomized to PrEP not only protects them from acquiring HIV, but also protects their contacts further down from that person, if that makes sense. So thinking about that one, we were thinking also about like medication for opioid use disorder. So that helps the person who's being treated for their own opioid use disorder. But then that person may also, because they're receiving good treatment, reduce their substance use, and then actually be encouraging others to also reduce their substance use and take more harm reduction measures. So I think, I don't know, the more you think about it, of course, there are definitely treatments that this wouldn't apply to, but the more you think about it, particularly for infectious diseases or other social influences, you know, this could come up a lot more than we maybe realized before.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I think for infectious disease, it totally makes sense that basically any intervention you're going to have is going to potentially have this issue, because it's, you know, if you're trying to mitigate an infectious disease, then you're hopefully changing the dynamics in the population in addition to in the individual. But the social aspect I hadn't thought of before, that's very interesting. Like in the opioid case, for example, that, you know, if you're encouraging harm reduction, maybe that person will in turn encourage it in their community. That's fascinating. How do you deal with it? Like, what's the best way to deal with that type of issue in the data that you see?
I guess I wouldn't say we have the best way, but we have have some ways. And I think that's sort of like a call, like for encouragement for anyone who's excited about this. I feel like there's so much work to do, and we're sort of just like cracking it open, like. And then, you know, traditional statistical inference relies on at least some independence assumptions. So the more complex the dependency, so if you no longer have any independent units in your data, inference becomes very challenging. So hopefully in our lifetimes, we'll see this move away from like the paradigm of everyone being independently and identically distributed and floating in space to methods that work for recognizing the fact that we're basically social creatures. Right. And we're all connected somehow, whether that's, you know, substance use, friendship, whatever, like there's all this connectivity happening in our data. So, yeah, so that's sort of like the problem with the statistical inference approaches. And for now, what we've been doing is just hoping that there is some way we can identify non-overlapping components in the data to at least conduct statistical inference. And then in terms of causality, to not get too technical, but what we think about is that so say the three of us were in a network together, or we were connected together. So my outcome would not only be influenced by my exposure, but the exposure status of you, of both of you. And that's sort of just a very simple way to explain how the potential outcomes would change. And then we can see very quickly, so instead of me having two potential outcomes, now I have my two potential outcomes times each of your two potential outcomes, which I think would end up being eight potential outcomes or so.
Wow. Yeah. That can get complicated very quickly.
Yeah. So it ends up being like two to the N usually, depending on how many people are in the group. And then you only get to see one of those potential outcomes. So it becomes a very challenging problem quickly.
It's like an enormous missing data problem.
Exactly.
Where you're missing like way the majority of the data, like to an exponential degree. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some earlier approaches that are like randomization based inference and sort of averaging over the distribution of all the missing data, that type of thing.
So one of the approaches I know that you've been working on, because we've been working on it together for this, is with simulating. Do you want to talk about how simulation like lets you kind of explore this potential outcome space a bit more?
Sure. Yeah. So, and this is work that Ellie and I have ongoing with Brandon Marshall's group at Brown. So in this, we're using an agent-based modeling setting to actually simulate what's known as a two-stage randomized design. So we simulate a sexual network with components, so like separate clusters, and then the clusters are randomized to be intervention or control. And then within the intervention clusters, individuals are then randomized to, in this case, the example is pre-exposure prophylaxis or not. You know, in the real world, of course, that design would be, first of all, unethical and then possibly unfeasible. Because, you know, even if we were going to do that by provider practices or something, I don't think providers would want to have, you know, a certain number of patients that they could only allocate to PrEP. So we can use this agent-based model setting to simulate this randomized trial, and then taking the ideas from causal inference to quantify the effects in the agent-based model, we feel more confident or reassured that what we're estimating is a causal contrast.
So my buzzer finger is a little bit, it's like my trigger finger is not as fast as it once was. I need to get up to speed with my, in this new season. But you mentioned the word agent-based model a couple times in that. And do you mind just defining what that is? Because I know that's something, Ellie, that you work on a lot too. But just for the listener, what does it mean to be an agent-based simulation?
Yeah, so Ellie might want to add to this, but just very broadly, it's set up so there's individual agents, which we can think of as patients in this simulator. So it's in a mathematical like computer model, and then the agents are like they're given rules according to different probability distributions or different estimates in the data about how they'll behave once the model starts running, and then the model's updated like maybe every month, for example. And then depending on those rules, the model will actually just be interacting or doing what they do according to those distributions, those probability distributions. So think of like, I don't know, maybe it's just like an oversimplification, but sometimes if I'm trying to explain this to my mom, I tell her it's like kind of like Sim City or Sim Farm, except now instead of like the city or the farm, it's a sexual network of men who have sex with men in Atlanta. And seeing how they evolve over time, if we, you know, and then especially if we add different interventions, how that impacts the system as a whole.
And so like in a practical stance, like if you are, let's say you're doing this in Atlanta and you are simulating a network of like 50 men, would you the thing that makes it agent based is that you would like actually like draw from some distributions to actually get 50 individuals, like simulated individuals into your cohort, and you would like follow them over time based on the rules that you've set. And then you would sort of see how that would go. And then you do that a whole bunch of times. Am I understanding correctly?
Yep. That sounds right. So it's like each time the models run, I mean, I guess some people maybe have different approaches, but at least in the recent papers, good thing I just submitted it on Monday. So I just reread it on Monday. So it's fresh in my mind. So in ours, we actually regenerate the sexual network and the population characteristics with each run of the model. And then that creates some uncertainty that needs to be quantified across. So for that particular one, we ran the model 1,000 times. And then you look across all of those.
So it's kind of like you're simulating that you would look at, let's say it's 50 men, you would look at a population of 50 men, you'd sample 50 people from this like global population 1,000 times in your case with certain characteristics, and you're sort of getting to see what would happen if that were to be reality. It's nice. I think these types of models are really nice from a statistical standpoint for when I'm teaching, because it really nicely emulates like what we think we're doing when we do anything with frequentist properties, right? Like we're mm-hmm. in a frequentist setting, you are essentially doing a single agent based model. You're getting one sample and you're trying to sort of like guess what would have happened if you had done that same process many, many times. And I think an agent based model, at least my understanding of it, is it sort of is simulating that process as if you were able to resample from some global population a bunch of times.
Ellie, do you have anything to add? I know you've done a much more extensive amount of work in that area than I have.
Yeah, no, I think that was a great description. I think that's basically exactly what we're doing. You know, one thing I will say is that the terminology in the simulation world is like so field specific. So I think this is one place where I often run into trouble is like when I'm talking to different audiences, I have to kind of change how I'm talking about these models. So when we're talking to an infectious disease epidemiologist, you know, in that setting, an agent-based model is one of these individual level simulation models but specifically one in which this transmission spillover interference type issue happens. So if that's not happening in your model, then they wouldn't call it an agent-based model. Whereas in a health decision-making audience, a health policy audience, they would call any kind of individual level simulation model an agent-based model, regardless of whether you know, the individuals interact with each other or not. And so I think that that's one of the things that makes it a little bit difficult for people kind of getting into this world of simulation, is that these different fields use the same terms for different things and different terms for the same things. And it's, I mean, it's a big problem all across causal inference, really. But I think it's particularly a problem here.
Yeah, this is Ellie. When are we going to write that Rosetta Stone we keep talking about? I feel like we keep mentioning.
I know. I actually have got a student started on an agent-based model Rosetta Stone because we thought, okay, narrowing it down would help a little.
Oh, that's so great.
If anyone in our audience feels like their field has specific agent-based or simulation-related terminology, you know, let us know, and I'll have my student reach out and give you, interview you on how you use it in your field.
That's fabulous. I think that's going to be really valuable. I mean, I think I don't even know. I know you and I was trying to start this paper, and it's like the scope feels so large. So it makes sense to narrow in on agent-based models to start off with, because I don't know how to to be able to kind of have this thread throughout all the different words we use for all the different things. I mean, as we have different guests, we had a guest that was a little more econ policy focused who used some terminology that Ellie and I were like, wait, what are you talking about? That's not how we talk about that. So,
and causal inference seems to have that issue specifically as well for, you know, how we're calling different parameters or things we want to estimate. And then even like what we're, I guess some fields call what we call confounding, they call selection bias, and that it's very confusing.
Yes, this is a fabulous topic because Ellie and I talked about this a little bit last time, but that, like, in my mind, from a statistical standpoint, and it sounds like actually maybe you agree, that we could use the word confounding to cover almost all of the different terminology that we talk about. Like, selection bias is among them. You know, Simpson's paradox is one that people say a lot, and when they actually really are just referring to a confounded relationship. You know, we have all these words from different fields. Omitted variable bias is another one. I mean, that's just confounding. You know, these are all like ways to describe confounding where it's like, I don't know if it serves us to have different terminology when you could just say one thing, but.
Yeah, it's probably just an artifact of like the different disciplines evolving and then not enough like cross-pollinization.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully in this generation and like forward, there'll be more, you know, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary work. And I don't know, sometimes it's like you look over to the econ literature and you're like, oh, they already solved this. Or they already did this. We don't need to redo it. Yeah, it's always good to look over at our sister fields.
And thinking about, jargon that has the same words with different meanings, I think the context of interference, transmission, spillover, yep, and causal inference is a really interesting one there, because this is a case where there is the same words with completely different meanings. So maybe Ashley, would you feel like you could give a little bit of an explanation of like how the terms direct effect and indirect effect when used in an infectious context differ from what we would think about with direct effect and indirect effect in a non-infectious context for causal effects?
Yeah, I think what you might be pointing to, and it seems like in terms of spillover and interference, it feels like the terminology is just evolving and maybe things are settling possibly to, you know, this term spillover, which that came up in one of our recent papers. And then, you know, it's just sort of like, what do you name these effects? And I think the first paper I wrote in this area with Donna Spiegelman, we decided to actually rename, instead of interference, we wanted to call it dissemination, so it didn't have such a negative connotation. Though dissemination, I think some people think might mean diffusion. So now I'm throwing around like a lot of different words here, but, and then diffusion is something else where the exposure is moving out through the population. And then, yeah, so we decided to try to rename it basically to get away from the mediation terminology of direct and indirect effect in mediation. Although I think there's maybe like one simple case where you could frame the spillover as a mediation problem. So maybe there is some overlap there, but I think if people are used to working in the mediation literature and they see the direct effect and all, you know, and the indirect effect, they might be thinking about the effect directly on the outcome and then the indirect effect through the mediator. Whereas in spillover, the direct effect, or the interference rather, in the earlier papers, they call it the direct effect, which is the effect of being exposed in an intervention network. So you're in a network where, say, maybe 70% of the people you're connected to are exposed, and you're also exposed. compared to if you're in that same network but not exposed. And then the spillover is when you're in, for example, like a high coverage cluster. So a lot of people around you are being treated, but you're not treated yourself. So you're basically just getting the benefit from people around you being treated compared to, for example, being in a control cluster. And that would be called the indirect in terms of the interference or spillover. So it's like a lot of different words for maybe similar things. And then sometimes the words also might connect to like a slight change in how something's being defined. So you have to be like really careful. And sometimes they might use the same word and be defining it slightly differently. So I feel like when we're like really digging into these papers, the safest thing to do is, you know, really learn the notation, read what they're trying to estimate, what the parameter is, and understand it in the context of that paper. And then hopefully as time goes on, we can get crisper across like all these different papers on how we're defining things and why. And yeah, maybe there needs to be that Rosetta Stone thing just for interference, it seems like.
Yeah, well, you were just saying for direct versus indirect, am I understanding it correctly that it's almost the opposite of when we are talking about it through a mediator? Like if I were to think about, or maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but if I were to think about like the direct effect when I'm thinking about it in terms of mediation would be like the effect that doesn't pass through anything else, right? Whereas with interference, it sounds like the direct effect would be the one that like is what you're observing rather than what would be. Am I understanding that correctly, or did I misunderstand
I think I'd have to write it out to be 100% sure, but I think what the simplest case to link them is like if you think about just a dyad, like two people in a household, and then the exposure, it's like there's the person you're looking at, their exposure, and then the person they're connected to, their exposure. And then for person, so that's person one and then person two. So then person one's outcome is mediated through the exposure of person two.
Oh, so it's the same as mediation's terminology. Okay.
I think so. That's like one example where I think there's like you make a direct link. The other thing I was kind of rambling on about with the different coverage levels, which is the proportion of people treated in the cluster, that I don't think can be like directly mapped on. I think maybe it could, but I don't see it immediately. So,
okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Yeah, that does make sense. Thank you.
And these things are good to write down. It's hard to just do it on the fly.
Yeah, I know. This is the podcast as a medium is like, you know, sometimes a little challenging for things that maybe would be easier to have a whiteboard while we're chatting about it.
I don't have another question related to this topic. I thought maybe something that would be interesting to talk about, but we could either ask it now or wait a little bit, is just talking about like what it's like being a professor of biostats in a pharmacy practice department and a college of pharmacy. Because I imagine that's a little bit more interdisciplinary than, you know, if you were a professor of biostats in a biostats department, and maybe a little different than being in a school of public health or something. And, you know, I think some of our listeners might be interested in how that experience has been different for you, you know, what you like about it, whether there's challenges or things you've learned from doing it that would be useful for other people to know if they were going that route.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm happy to share. In terms of, you know, expanding out into a different area than maybe I would have gone if I went to a traditional biostats department, was being able to connect with basically health outcomes researchers and start thinking about work, not necessarily always causal inference, but work in routinely collected administrative health data and thinking there about, you know, I think it's been really interesting to think about, you know, some of Hernan's work about emulating a randomized trial using observational data. How can we take some of those ideas into health outcomes research, and having some colleagues as well as students, graduate students that I work with here on some of those aspects. We have thought a little bit about, you know, can we quantify any spillover effects in those types of databases, particularly if, you know, we have information maybe on providers or information on families. So I think that's been really interesting and possibly an area that I may not have gotten connected to if I hadn't been in a college of pharmacy. So, and then, you know, teaching the health outcomes students, I also teach some statistics students, and that's kind of more of a natural fit to my disciplinary area. But, you know, overall, I think, you know, in terms of the graduate students here, they seem very interested in wanting to learn about causal inference methods, and particularly focused on learning how to use propensity score analyses and how to use those appropriately. So those are quite popular. So I get a lot of questions about that and interest in my class on those topics specifically. And then teaching more broadly with the the PharmD students, and then also undergraduate students. So they're, the main challenge or interesting part of my job is how do I communicate these topics to people who maybe, decided they just, quote unquote, didn't like math, which, stats is not math, but, we have to get over that barrier first. And then, at least try to share, something interesting or open up something to clarify. So it's not like this big confusing black box that they just have to kind of pull a p-value out of some table. And then they think that's all statistics is. So trying to bring, some of my excitement, enthusiasm, and, bringing more visuals and graphics and examples from the literature to class. So, trying to keep it interesting.
One thing you mentioned in that was your students' interest in propensity scores. I feel like I jumped in on this one topic, but I think, I don't know that we've talked a little bit about propensity scores, Ellie, but maybe we haven't fully given a sense for what that is. So maybe we could do a quick diversion to explain kind of how that would be used in the context that your students might be working in.
That's a great question. So do we need to define it, or do no buzzer there? Do you think?
I'm going to buzz myself because I guess I said it. I could define it. I could do the first part and then I'll pass it off. So a propensity score, the big idea here is especially when you're dealing in a non-randomized setting where, people, although propensity scores can be used in randomized settings too, but I feel like often you see it used to help you try to quantify the probability of exposure. And so, if you're in a randomized setting, your probability of exposure is defined by the randomization scheme. And you would expect if randomization didn't fail that wouldn't be dependent on any of the things that would make a person unique, right? Because it would be some random process that defined what their exposure was. But in the real world, often people's exposures are defined by their characteristics in some sense, or they're driven by their characteristics. So for example, if I'm a little bit sicker and I go to my doctor, then maybe they're going to be more willing to have me try some new kind of treatment regime. And so if I didn't adjust for that when I was trying to see how well that treatment regime worked, it could look like that, people tend to be sicker on this treatment. And it's only because people who are sicker tend to get the treatment. So anyways, propensity scores basically are a way to quantify your probability of getting a treatment, your probability of exposure. And the big theory behind it is if you can accurately quantify that, so if you can do that kind of without having any unmeasured confounders, so you can basically account for all the things that would make somebody get a certain exposure, and as long as there's kind of a non-zero probability that any given person in your cohort could be exposed or unexposed, then you could use that probability or that propensity score to estimate a true causal effect. So how did that sound, Ashley? Did I do okay?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
I should have had you give my lecture the other day. I could have caught up on some work.
Well, so what's the context that then your students tend to use these, or what kind of questions are they trying to answer?
Yeah. So they're, health outcomes like pharmacoepidemiology. So they're, they're looking at, routinely collected health data. So, right. By definition, that's an observational study. In, typically a very fuzzy observational study, if you will. So the granularity of information is a little fuzzy, but at the same time, it's part of patient's routine care. So between, the patient and the provider, there are lots of decisions being made about, which treatment, when, how long, why. So it's clearly not a randomized setting. And then what students hope to do is with, measuring enough confounders and the appropriate confounders using propensity scores. I do see in the pharmacoepidemiology field a lot of matching done. It seems to be very strongly advocated for method in their field. So basically making a propensity score, estimating the propensity score for each person, and then based on the propensity score, matching exposed and unexposed to each other to balance those groups. I encourage them also to think about inverse probability weighting approaches. It's a different thing to do with the propensity score. And then there's also like stratification you can stratify by the propensity score and then estimate the effects within each of those stratum. So basically really to control for measured confounding. And then that being said, because it's routinely collected data, there's never going to be a guarantee that they've, captured all the correctly measured confounders. It tends to be very little information on lifestyle factors, disease severity. Those are sort of the big ones. So then what I try to do is when I'm advising students is to push them a little bit further and think about sensitivity analyses for unmeasured confounding, which there are, it's an evolving field, but there are a couple of nice things out there that students can do. If it's a statistics student, I would push them to actually do like a full-blown sensitivity analysis with including excluding the unmeasured variable and maybe doing a simulation study. If it's a health outcome student, I might point them towards something like the E-value from Vanderweil.
Do you want to talk about the E-value? I think we've done that before, but we should do it again. This is like, I'm getting better with my buzzer.
Yeah, we can define that. So let's see. Let's see if I remember all the nuances. So the basic idea is it's a way that you can quantify the threat of unmeasured confounding in your analysis. So, and then the actual way to calculate the E-value depends on the parameter that you're looking at, of course. And then it gives you a sense of, and then you get an estimated E-value. And then based on that E-value, your unmeasured confounder would need to have an estimate that big or bigger to basically blow your results, to bias your results. Does that sound like what you remember?
Yeah, I think so. I think I usually say that's like the minimum strength of association, the minimum like kind of risk ratio scale, I think typically is what it's on, although you could do a hazard ratio or an odds ratio that an unmeasured confounder would need in order to render your result usually inconclusive. Like it tends to be that you do the E value either on the point estimate. And so for like a risk ratio or a hazard ratio or an odds ratio, the null hypothesis there would be that it's one, so that the two groups are equal. And so the E value would be what is the minimum strength of association for an unmeasured confounder that would need to pull that result, that point estimate to one, or you could do it on the confidence interval. So like maybe if the effect is greater than one, you could say, what would it need to be to pull the lower bound down to one? Or if it's less than one, the upper bound up to one. The E-value is very interesting. Some of my dissertation research was like on kind of similar methods to the E-value, although with fewer constraints, because the E-value is constrained in that it's the minimum strength of association. But if you're dealing with binary outcomes, for example, you have to make some assumptions about the prevalences, and it basically makes the most extreme assumptions. And so there's like always things to, but I think that what your assessment is exactly right. That's what I would do with my students too, kind of depending on their background, what my recommendations might be. And certainly in the literature, if you're doing any kind of sensitivity analyses, you're like far and ahead above what the average paper is doing. And so I think that even just using an E-value and thinking about these problems is like really a good step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's like more fully acknowledging the threat of unmeasured confounding. And, if you get a hazard, I think in one of our analyses, it was like a hazard ratio of 9. And then we were looking at the hazard ratios of all the other covariates, right? And they were like around 1 to 3 or something, and then some protective ones as well. And, we felt pretty good that you didn't want to say it like ruled out unmeasured confounding, but, we'd say this is some evidence that unmeasured confounding, may not be as big of a threat in this particular analysis. But I still feel like that's a tough pill for people to swallow in routinely collected health data. So I think, even as that paper goes to get published, that sentence may be like scaled back even further.
I know. It's so interesting that you say that. I had this whole, one of my dissertation papers was on, the whole point was on trying to like ground your sensitivity analysis in your observed covariates. And it's a really challenging, I think it's really a worthy cause, but it's very challenging to figure out the right way to do it. And, this paper has not been published yet. It's been sort of going around, and someone actually recently reached out to me and pointed out a flaw in my logic that I think was really poignant, that I was sort of saying, you know, we can use these measured confounders in order to help us think about like what size, what magnitude of an effect we've seen. And that can kind of help us exactly as you're saying, we've only seen things with ones and twos. We think we've measured some really important things. Nothing has anything close to a nine. So, you know, we're probably in a safe position. And I think in that kind of extreme, it certainly is useful. But when you're in kind of the minutia, like the closer minutia, if you, by adding in a measure, an unmeasured confounder into your result, it'll change your other confounding relationships. And so even though, like if the largest confounder that you observed was a two, and if you had another unmeasured confounder that had exactly that same profile, you know, it could tip your result, even though that two wouldn't have, if that makes it, like adding in an additional. And so this is something I've been really thinking about, like, how do we find that happy medium between being able to give people context to be able to like understand their result, and then when you're really drilling down into it, how to not say too much in certain settings. And so,
yeah, it's like a tricky question, because it's like something that wasn't, it's like you have your set that you measured, and then you're trying to say something about that something that wasn't measured, and you just you won't ever really know, right, for sure. And then, yeah, as it gets closer to like what the empirical estimates are in the data, I think it gets even more nuanced and challenging.
Simulation, I guess, does solve some of this, because you can actually create a variable and see what happens. But
and then just look across the range, and then, you know, see how it looks across the whole range of the unmeasured.
One other thing that you mentioned that I'm interested in, just like you mentioned kind of in passing, that most people do matching in this pharmacoepi space. When I was at Vanderbilt, I worked, my RA was with the VA there, and I was on a pharmacoepi team, and we did a lot of these like large scale medical record research. And that was my experience too. Most of the clinicians we worked with were really excited about matched cohorts. In one of the papers we did, we were able to convince them to do weighting as a secondary analysis and present both of the results, and they both showed the same thing. And my hope was, you know, if we get weighting into this paper, then maybe the next paper people will feel more comfortable with weighting. But do you have a theory as to why matching tends to be more? I have some theories, but I'm interested in hearing what you think about why maybe matching is more appealing to clinicians or people that you tend to work with, and kind of how do you approach that as a statistician when you're thinking about these types of questions and what methods you'll use?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, you know, what the appeal is. Maybe like conceptually people can think about it as being closer to like basically randomizing the treatment assignment, possibly. Although with inverse probability weighting, you know, to me that links up too. But I guess if you haven't, you know, if that hasn't been, you know, taught in your classes or your short courses at your conferences, then, you know, maybe that seems a little bit more foreign. I think one thing that seems to be missing, or people like gloss over a lot, is depending on how you've done the matching, it can change your causal parameter, is my understanding, right? So
yes,
if you match like back to your treated group, it's the average causal effect in the treated, average treatment effect in the treated, right?
Right.
And I think, no, that has a slightly different interpretation than the average causal effect.
Yeah, this is exactly, so I think that my theory aligns with yours. I think I theorize that it's like people are used to looking at a table one with whole number people, and matching, you know, first of all, you can think of it as like you do the process. It's sort of like selecting your cohort, like with exclusion and inclusion criteria in a clinical trial, except now you're just excluding or including or excluding based on basically your like caliper, the distance that you have between your propensity to have gotten treatment and like the other people in this like initial cohort that sort of whittles down to this matched cohort. But once you've done that, you don't have to think about the fact that you had to define this cohort ever again. You can just proceed as if you were in a randomized trial, you know? And I think that that's really appealing. Those whole number of people in your table one, I found that, you know, and I struggle with it because I love weighting. I'm always excited about doing some inverse probability weighting. I love the variance properties of it. It does tend to, in my experience in these large studies, give very similar answers to matching. So if a clinician would trust the matching better, maybe I need to just let it go and like do the thing that's going to get them to agree with my result, you know? So I think this like question of like statistical purity versus like translational research, what's going to get them in the clinic to like utilize the treatment that we're talking about, is like, I don't know. These are all, I'm excited to talk to you about this because these are all questions that I think about a lot with kind of, and your point about the causal estimate is exactly right. I think even when you're not when you're matching to the treated group, of course, you're estimating this average treatment effect among the treated, but even just matching in general, or you use any kind of, like if you're excluding anybody on either side, you're really not estimating the average treatment effect in the same way. Like you're estimating something like the average treatment effect among the matchable, right? Like this is like a slightly different quantity and people don't really think about that. And there are weights that can be analogous to that, that have really nice properties. But anyways, I think that this is like an important question when people are thinking about what methods they're using.
Yeah. And I think with the matching too, another thing that I think is really important is, you know, making sure the matching did what, you know, what you expected it to do, like doing some diagnostics for that instead of just doing it and moving on. Or compare, I think I see some people comparing it with p-values, which isn't quite right. So you want to be using, like, I think standardized mean difference is a nice way, or looking at the overlap and the distribution of the propensity scores. And maybe there's other things that are valid too, but
my favorite is it's using standardized mean differences, but putting them in a nice plot where you kind of order it and you can see how like the impact of your balancing. So you can look at this like a plot of the standardized mean differences pre and post matching or weighting or whatever. And I have heard this called a love plot because Thomas Love was the first to use it. And so I think that's lovely. I like to use love plots whenever I'm teaching. I always tell my students this is a love plot. I think it's yeah.
Yeah, I think that the discussion about like what the estimand is so important because I think that's something we don't see a lot of conversation about in applied studies. Like, you know, a lot of applied people, researchers don't really, you know, have the background to kind of differentiate like what is the causal estimand they're trying to estimate. And then, you know, in meta-analyses, what we see is people like just combining a bunch of things that are all estimating different quantities. And so, you know, one of the things you talked about was trying to communicate this to pharmacy students or undergrads or people who are kind of math phobic. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you kind of communicate that idea of like, what is the question that you're answering with a particular analysis and how that changes depending on your analysis when you're talking to those audiences?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a very, very simple thing. So it's like, you know, if I'm in a classroom with a bunch of statisticians, you know, I'm writing primarily in notation and things are just like moving quicker. And I personally feel more at home because it's very, very, very precise. Right. And then walking into a room with people from different backgrounds and different disciplines, and then I'm trying to translate what I'm reading in that formula into what's in the problem. Like talking about the exposures, interventions, or treatments in their problem and the outcomes to like communicate what we're actually estimating there. Yeah, just trying to like to translate it and make it very clear in basically in English, so that they understand like what we're quantifying or even, you know, being very clear about what, you know, we've applied these methods to quantify a causal effect. But then there's this long paragraph of limitations that we need to acknowledge, right? Or threats to that thing that we've estimated.
Yeah, I think for me, that's like often the hardest thing is like you sort of start laying out, okay, these are all the assumptions you need to accept in order to give this a causal interpretation. And then you get this kind of pushback from people who have learned the statistics without learning the causal inference side. And they're like, well, I don't want to make those assumptions. So I'm just going to use regression. And because when I see a regression, just, you know, logistic regression presented in a paper, I don't see this list of things. And, you know, I always like trying to explain like, well, those assumptions are also made there, plus some other ones. They're just not talking about it. But getting students to kind of understand that these aren't additional assumptions that you're making because you're using propensity score a lot of times. They're assumptions you'd be making anyway. It's just maybe they're more realistic in the propensity score setting. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on how to convince people of that more successfully.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way it's like the potential outcomes framework, it just like puts your feet to the fire for like the assumptions that are needed. It's, you know, it's quantitative. Like you can't argue your way out of it. It's just like, it's this, and that. You need these assumptions. We don't have to go over them now because we have like a couple minutes left. But, you know, these are the identification assumptions. And then, you know, it relies on your model being fit correctly and all these other things that if you gloss over those, you know, you could potentially be not only getting the wrong variance or the wrong confidence interval, but you can also be getting the wrong point estimate. Or in, even in big data, I like to say, you know, we can be precisely wrong, which is a scary and dangerous thing, right? So it's going to always reject, but we, you know, the truth could be null and we could be, you know, saying there's a really strong effect.
Yeah, this makes me think a little bit of like Miguel's paper on like the C word. I hate the name of that paper, but it's called like the C word. Do you know which paper I'm talking about? We can link to it. But basically, he's talking about like the C word being causation and how people.
I was worried it was a different C word.
I know. This is why I hate that paper. I like the paper. I hate the title. I find it too provocative. Yeah. It's like just. Yeah.
Uh-oh, where are we going with this one?
Way too much for my Catholic upbringing. But I feel like he's spot on in the idea that like people kind of will dance around this idea of causation by saying, you know, oh, we're just doing an association. We just did a regression, like no big deal. When in fact, they're trying to get a causal estimate and like using the proper methods and owning that that's what you're trying to do is actually going to be like a much better result. You know, I know like even there was a paper that Leslie and Jeff Leek and Leah worked on a while ago that was on this like idea of explaining observational data and how even when people don't use the word, the like kind of the C word, the causal word, if there's any explanation in the discussion, they found they did this study and with students, and if there was kind of any explanation of like why the results might be what they are, which basically all discussions include things like that, then causality is assumed regardless of if the methods actually support the causal assumptions, right? And so I think that this is like a big problem where people kind of try to not have to do the hard stuff in order to avoid kind of they try to just say, oh, it's just an association study, but it's like, why would you do it? Just as, I mean, this comes back to what Ellie and I talked to Roger Pang about a while ago about how most things are causal inference, because why would you care if it's not causal? It's like what is the, I mean, there certainly are some cases where we would care when it's not causal, but for the most part, like the reason we're measuring these things is because we are trying to draw some cause and effect. We're not just trying to like, you know, describe like a we're not just doing a descriptive study, I guess. If we were, we would explicitly do that.
Yeah, I think I totally agree when it's like a treatment, prescription drug, anything like that, right? And then people are saying, oh, it's associated, but, you know, really they wanted to do causal, but either doubted their data, their methods, their study design enough to make that interpretation. And then I think only because this came up in my class the other day, I think the field that where it's like not clear, like if it's definitely causal all the time, is like social epidemiology and health disparities, right? So there's larger, this isn't my field, so, you know, just disclaimer, but there's these larger social, contextual, structural factors. And, you know, do we want to be casting that into a quantitative causal framework or not? And there's a really interesting series, just a plug for a series from AJE last year, on social epidemiology and causal inference. And if you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. No definitive answers, but, you know, I guess at the end of the day, it seems like causal inference should be learning from social epi, and social epi can learn from causal inference, but we definitely have work to do.
Yeah, I think that that's an important kind of conversation that, like, in the quantitative side, we have causal effect estimation and, you know, the potential outcomes framework gives us a nice set of tools for that. It's clear what assumptions we need to make. We have, you know, worked out the math and, you know, the logic for a number of different types of scenarios we're interested in. And so if we're interested in estimating a quantitative causal effect, like this is the tool we should be using. We should not be using any of those other vague associational things. But then there's this question of like, are there other questions about causation that we might want to ask where we're not necessarily interested in a quantitative causal effect estimate? And I think that a lot of the social epi pieces, it kind of comes down to that, where it's like, well, we want to understand, like, is something historical, does that have ramifications in terms of current disease processes? But we're not asking like an interventional causal effect estimation question about that historical action. We're sort of more kind of coming at it from a variety of different angles. And I think that that's, you know, I think it would be great for the sort of quantitative causal effect estimation to be able to develop some tools to help with that. But I think partly it one of the big problems is it seems like, at least on the social epi side, that they feel that the potential outcomes framework isn't really the right definition, like philosophical definition of a cause in that setting. And so until there's a clear idea of what a better philosophical definition of a cause is, we can't really develop quantitative tools for helping with that, with that type of causation. So I think that that's, you know, I think it's somewhere where there needs to be like a lot more discussion between the sort of quantitative and quantitative causal people and the social epi causal people.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us, Ashley. This has been a really good conversation. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a true delight, and I hope we can keep these conversations going.
Is there somewhere online that people can find you or follow your research?
I do have a website. I can share the link with you after. It's not particularly catchy. It's uri.edu/ncipher.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciated it.
All right. Well, that was an awesome conversation with Ashley. Thanks for getting her on, Ellie.
Yeah, it was great.
It was really enjoyable. I feel like she and I have all different things to talk about offline because she has a lot of shared interest with the stuff that she does.
That is the best kind of guest for sure.
I know. I feel like I could pick her brain about all kinds of things, like especially talking about like the idea of translational research, like thinking about what the goal of your research is. Like, is the goal to publish a paper? No, your goal is probably to like get people to actually do the thing that you're promoting as good or bad or not do. You know, like if it's a treatment, you want people to use the treatment if it works. You want them to not use it if it doesn't work. And so if that's the goal, you need to like use methods that are both statistically rigorous and like build trust in the people who you are hoping to enact change, right? Or to make decisions.
Yeah. And I think that that's like, that's really difficult because you need the audience to, you know, the people that you're hoping will use the information. They need to understand what you've done. They need to believe it. They need to understand the limitations of what you've done. And I think, you know, especially when we're trying to do better with better methods, it can be really difficult because we have to first explain those better methods to the end users in a way that they can learn to trust them.
Right. Yeah. And I think like, yeah, I've been trying to think of ways to study this phenomenon, like to study, you know, I think I had mentioned on the podcast that a student and I, my student Hannah, had worked on a randomized, a quick randomized study where we tried to look at whether kind of giving more information about a health recommendation made people more or less likely to like trust a change in recommendation later. So it was sort of this idea of like, if we explain to you why we're making this recommendation and then we change the recommendation, are you more likely to like go along with the change than if we just sort of told you the first time, this is the way it is. And then we told you, oh, actually it's like this opposite thing instead. And it was I think it would definitely need to be replicated, but in the results were interesting in that we did see that people seemed to trust that they did seem to like take a second recommendation more often if they were given the full information the first time. But given that uncertainty the first time, if you just look at that segment, like if there was just one recommendation, being given uncertainty makes people less likely to take the recommendation, which makes sense because they are given full information about the, you know, amount of uncertainty associated with that recommendation. And I think the same is probably true. I mean, I'd love to figure out how to study this, but among clinicians, like when you give them a result with no qualifications, then they're going to, and they kind of don't have any other information to go on. They might run with that result because it looks very confident versus if you give them the result with the accurate kind of list of limitations, it could make them less likely to take it, even though that's actually the more appropriate way to present the result. Anyways, I feel like I'm thinking about like, what are we supposed to be doing? Like, how do we...
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something I've been thinking about so much too, because it's like all the methods of development in the world doesn't help if people don't use the methods and if people don't trust the results of the methods. So, you know, I had some work that I've done kind of trying to talk to patients about different types of information we could get from studies and how they might use that information to make decisions. And I'm trying to get a similar thing going with looking at oncologists and how they might think about interpreting the results of different studies. But I think it's really challenging. You know, I had a reviewer comment on one thing where we were trying to use causal methods to identify, you know, the optimal treatment strategy for particular groups of patients. And then the reviewer comment was kind of like, well, clinicians don't really listen to guidelines. So is it even worth doing this? And it was like, well, if it's not, why do we have
guidelines?
Yeah. So like there must be something that can be useful. And how do we convince, how do we convey information in a way that's going to be useful for the, you know, end users, the clinicians and the patients, but also, you know, if we're not in the health setting, the website users or whatever our audience is, how do we convey the information to them in a way they can use?
Yeah, it's this like intersection between being like factually or mathematically or whatever kind of correct and also like useful and interesting. And like, I it's really hard to kind of find that right quadrant.
Yes.
Well, anyways, this was a fun conversation. Our next episode, I am really excited. We are going to be interviewing Len Testa, who is from Touring Plans, which is a company that works with Disney data. This is like my dream, Ellie. I can't even tell you how excited I am.
This is amazing. Our longtime listeners will know that Disney is Lucy's like favorite thing. Almost every episode on this podcast, we have somehow incorporated some comment about Disney. So I think it's been really exciting to talk about how data analysis is happening in the Disney context. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation too.
Yeah. So, and it's actually neat because Len has, he also has used some of the same methods that he uses on Disney data he's used in the medical space. And so I think he's going to be able to talk to us a little bit about those analogies as well, which I think is going to be very neat, hopefully for our listeners. Also for me, Len has a podcast called Disney Dish, which is one of my favorite podcasts. So like, there's so many reasons why this is exciting. I feel like we're catering to a narrow subset of people who are excited about Disney and causal inference. And I am like the queen of that subset.
I'm not convinced that subset is as narrow as you think. I suspect it's larger. But yeah, we are catering to that subset. But yes, I think it's going to be really cool.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very exciting. So anyways, that's just a little teaser for our next episode, which will be coming out in 2 weeks.
Yes, stay tuned. Do we have anything else to update our listeners on this week?
I don't think so. I mean, we mentioned in our intro that we have a new logo. Give us some feedback. Obviously, nothing is set in stone, but I think it's kind of fun. And so it's always fun to get a little freshen up.
Exactly. All right. Well, then I think that this is a wrap on season 3, episode 2. So huge thank you to our guest, Dr. Ashley Buchanan from the University of Rhode Island. We will put her website information in the show notes. You can follow our podcast at Casual Infer on Twitter. You can send us email at casualinfer@gmail.com. You can follow our partner journal, American Journal of Epidemiology, on Twitter at amjepi. You can follow Lucy at LucyStats, and you can follow me at EpiEllie. And we look forward to talking with you about Disney next week.
Woohoo!